application, but then at the bottom, it's going to say, it's required, so you have to put something.
Oh, cool.
You do have to put something, so why not put As Goes Wisconsin?
Even though Brian Kelly, who's coming up next on Dueling Tangents with Luke Mathers, did mention yesterday that his life was potentially in harm's way.
I know, and I love Brian, and I'll miss Brian, but... Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Network. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair. Thank you for joining us today during your lunch hour, the noon hour. Coming up later at 12:30, Alan Borsick is going to be here, who is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School. He also is a former education beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and did that for years and still writes a lot about education. In fact, one of his articles that came out in late December was what's in the capital forecast for education in Wisconsin this session. And I think we've already seen a lot of that start to get played out with the state of the state last week. And as budget negotiations get rolling on how do we fix and improve our schools, the ongoing debate around voucher programs. And for someone like him who knows so much about this, I'm super excited to hear more details and objective details, because I feel like especially when it comes to the voucher program, it's hard to get someone who really can talk about it objectively because people feel so strongly one way or the other.
Very much so.
Whether it's public schools and supporting our public schools versus charter schools, private schools, and like that, it also is like I don't even fully wrap my head around the web of what voucher programs entails and what's the difference between a private school and a charter school and how much money do each get and how does the teacher union play into it. And
there's, sure.
It's so complicated, but people get so feverish on their point of view when it comes to this topic. So I'm hoping that he can give us a primer that kind of lays the foundation for understanding the arguments and the budget negotiations as they come up. So I'm really looking forward to that. And but for now, I thought we'd just talk because I feel like this is going to be every other day, at least something, because if you haven't heard, which if you listen to Civic Media and our show or any of the other shows, you probably already know about this.
I think you've heard.
But you probably have friends who haven't heard. So we're going to keep reminding you so that you can keep reminding your friends. And of course, we're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, which as of tomorrow, we are 3 weeks away from the primary.
Yep.
And
narrowed down from 4 to 2.
Narrowed down from 4 to 2. But this is nonpartisan. So in some weird world, two of the left-leaning candidates could get through, or two of the right-leaning candidates could get through. Highly improbable that that will happen.
It's possible,
but
the odds are kind of astronomical.
Because unlike partisan primaries, so like in Senate District 8, which is having a special election, and normally something for a state Senate race would happen in the fall, but because Alberta Darling stepped down before her term ended, it is happening now. But in that situation, there is now three still Republicans running.
I believe so.
But only one Democrat. And so instead of the top two between the four of them getting through, the Democrat automatically gets through because she's the only one running. And then the other three have to duke it out amongst themselves. And so this brings up a whole different conversations as far as maybe we could learn something from partisan primaries and nonpartisan primaries and final five voting and all of these different things that could be helpful for our democracy and curb some of our partisanship. But maybe not, because this is supposed to be, this being the Wisconsin Supreme Court, is supposed to be a nonpartisan race, and yet it is quite clearly very partisan.
Yeah.
And so, so, but it's also, on top of everything, looking like it could be the most expensive court race in not only in our state history, but like in the nation's history.
Tons of money.
Tons of money. Wisconsin's next Supreme Court race is on pace to be the most expensive in state history and potentially nationwide. This is written by Molly Beck at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So just to rewind a little bit, as of right now, the conservatives have a 4-3 majority on our highest state court. And if we were to flip this, if Protasiewicz or Everett Mitchell were to make it through the primary and then win the general, it would be the first time that liberals held a majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 15 years. And so it's been a while. And a lot has changed and a lot has been... Wisconsin changed a lot, I guess, in the 17 years I was gone. But this is now going to come down to the fact that who can raise the most money, who can get brand awareness or brand like name recognition out there. Because so far, the Democrats and Ben Wickler have proven in the statewide elections that they're pretty good. And as far as raising a lot of money and winning statewide. So this is going to be, I hope you liked your break in December and January as far as a little bit of a break from political campaign ads, because we're about, basically, I think once the primary is done, it's going to get wild because there's a lot at stake. So Republicans are worried that if a liberal candidate wins, the court could repeal Act 10. They could squash school choice voucher programs. We could adopt new legislative maps that are actually fair and don't give Republicans the huge advantage that they've had for over 10 years now. If a liberal judge won, that's going to be potentially the deciding decision when it comes to this 1849 abortion ban, which I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes the cornerstone of the election. And that unapologetically, the two liberal candidates campaign on that. Because if we look at what happened in November, this ban is not popular. And so if that can be conveyed to voters, it may motivate them to vote in higher and have an actual higher turnout than we ever usually have. Because as I've said before, 44% voter turnout in the last 22 years is our lowest we've ever had in Wisconsin for fall partisan races, and our highest in the last 22 years for spring nonpartisan races is 34%. So it would be great if we could at least break that and have more than 34% of voters actually turn out for the April 4th election, because there is a lot at stake and literally the entire country is watching us. Because not only, you know, does it help us, whoever is in that seat helps decide the future of our state when it comes to legislative maps and comes to abortion, but don't forget that our Wisconsin Supreme Court is also who made decisions in the 2020 election ultimately. And it was Brian Hagedorn who then, you know, notoriously voted with the liberal justices.
Yep. Few people haven't forgotten about that either.
Yeah. And then that supposedly is why Trump didn't give Clayfish his endorsement, because Hagedorn's kid and Clayfish's kid like went to prom together or something.
And the betrayal.
Oh my gosh. And so the fact that this seat could also be a deciding factor in the 2024 presidential election is why the whole country is watching us. And so it is a big deal.
It is a huge deal.
It is a big deal. And it is going to be a lot of money spent. And we didn't talk about this. I think this came out about 2 weeks ago as far as fundraising. And they are smaller numbers than I think what we started to see or what we saw with both the governor's race and the Senate race in the fall. But Protasiewicz, as of right now, after the last recording and reporting session, has more money on hand than all three candidates combined.
That will change after the primary.
I think. think so. I mean, right now, though, and it's interesting because if money speaks, and it's unclear to me, at least, probably other people know, how long has she secretly been running in the background? And so with that, did she, you know, how long has she been raising this money and just wasn't, like, talking about her campaign? Because both of the conservative candidates launched their campaigns into the reporting cycle, but they each have a little bit more than three, they being Judge Jennifer Doro and Dan Kelly, both have a little over $300,000 on hand, and Judge Everett Mitchell has about $115,000 on hand, at least at the time of this getting reported. And so it's interesting because it seems like the two conservative candidates are really splitting donors to have both of their fundraising efforts be almost equivalent as of right now.
Yeah.
Versus Protasiewicz, I think, maybe having more of the machine behind her, especially because the people who are running her campaign are the same people who ran Karofsky's campaign.
Oh, sure.
And so, so we'll see. But, I mean, it is hard to not think that, just like everything, the money matters. Especially when it comes to this, because we're going to have Jim Santel back on Monday or on Wednesday and have a whole hour kind of talking about this, because I maintain that how does the average person who doesn't really interact with the legal system, beyond your values, how do you pick a Supreme Court judge that you want to sit on the court? Like,
well, and he's going to basically explain the types of cases that come before our Supreme Court, right? So that should help people make a decision about who is most qualified to sit on that body.
Yes. And I mean, and is it too idealistic to think that that is how anyone who is going to vote in this race actually objectively wants to vote? Or is it like, does it just come down because there is so much partisan politics at play of how this is ultimately what our court has become, unfortunately, that it's just the hyper-partisan people who understand that who are the people going to vote inevitably. All right. Well, when we come back, some FDA updates. Well, one CBD, not so much of an update, and another HIV, kind of an update. A lot of acronyms. Stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. So, Jane, how do you feel about, do you use CBD products at all for any pains or aches or relaxation?
I do not, but I do have relatives who do.
Okay. So it's popular.
It is, definitely.
You know, I think my husband, who has back issues, uses like a salve balm thing. My mom has some kind of roller stick thing that is, whether it's a placebo effect or it doesn't really matter because she feels like it works. And so that's all that matters.
Absolutely.
And so the FDA doesn't really know what to do with them. So the FDA calls on lawmakers to help regulate CBD. So we've talked about the FDA before, as far as what they approve and don't approve. And I think as of last week, we were talking about they had approved abortion pills. So now there's going to be, they're having a lawsuit, or companies that make the abortion pills are suing states that are not allowing them to be distributed, saying that federal law, thus the FDA, should trump any state laws. So that's a whole thing. We've criticized the FDA in what they have allowed to go into our products, namely, you know, PFAS into our makeup and our food and water and all this other stuff of
it's
chemicals.
Fine. It's fine. It's just fine.
But they are now saying, well, we don't know what to do with this when it comes to CBD. So CBD is a non-psychoactive compound found in marijuana and hemp plants. And because of that, the FDA is saying they can't regulate it. And instead, it is calling on lawmakers to help devise, supervise, you know, our $12 CBD lavender sodas that are legal in some states. So it's basically because CBD doesn't fit into the mold of dietary supplements. So like the, you know, vitamin C and the different things that we take there. And so they're typically looking at dietary supplements or food additives and, or like ginseng and caffeine. But the agency claims that the science is lacking on the safety of long-term CBD use, let alone what the potential perks are, like preventing diabetes or aiding sleep. And so they're just kind of saying, we're not, this is out of our wheelhouse. And so since Congress legalized hemp 4 years ago, and most CBD is derived from hemp, not marijuana, the result is that CBD got kicked off of the controlled substances list and got lobbed into the Drug Enforcement Administration's desk to the FDA's. And so since then, the FDA has been basically less active in regulating CBD, and it's resulted in chaotic and confusing marketplace of what companies can claim their product does what. And I think most CBD industry players are hoping that the FDA will start reining it in. But it kind of just seems like everyone's throwing their hands up and says, not my circus, not my monkeys.
Oh, great. You do it.
Yes, exactly.
You take care of it. Thank you.
And so a different update, though, something that they actually are, I think, is can be seen as a good thing, is that the FDA is making moves on easing blood donor restrictions on gay and bisexual men, which I know for a long time. I mean, I just donated blood on MLK Day.
That's right.
And there was still a fair amount of questions on that questionnaire.
Sure.
Of your gender, your sexual orientation, your sexual practices. And I know that this has been a frustration for a long time for gay and bisexual men, or men who have sex with other men, because they are very healthy. They would like to be able to donate blood, but because of the HIV AIDS crisis in the 1980s, it's been 30 years basically saying,
you
no, thank you. Yeah. And so, this was a new guidance listed on Friday to relax blood donor restrictions, and the plan would ease restrictions that were set during the 1980s, which several medical organizations and LGBTQ organizations say are discriminatory. And so approximately 20% of community blood centers across the U.S. have a one-day supply or less.
Wow.
As of Friday morning.
That's so I think not good.
This is not good. So I think as much as anything, this is also the need. I mean, this is a reminder, if you can donate blood, donate blood.
Do it.
Because there is a need for it.
And these people know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And but also the fact that they, I think they finally have gotten to the point that they need to re-examine maybe what was an outdated restriction. And that the environment is very different than it was in the 1980s. And so I think this is a good thing. The FDA is expected to make the guidance official after a period of public comment. So that is right now. And if I can find the link to that, I will put it on today's blog notes for the show. But yeah, I just thought a lot of acronyms to start. FDA with CBD and HIV and what else we have?
And go give blood, by the way.
Yeah.
Go give blood.
And you see if you can get it and fill up your bags in 5 minutes or less.
There
because
is
that's what I did. Actually, technically, it was 5 minutes and 4 seconds.
Ooh.
But I did win the day. And so I did not pass out afterwards. I had my goldfish snacks.
Good, good, good.
But yeah, if you can. You know what I also didn't realize? That a lot of college students are donating plasma to make money.
That's been going on for a long time.
Has it?
Oh, yeah.
I was talking, when I was in, this was in December, that I was with my cousin, who we've had on the show before, Aiden, And his friends were talking about how often they go. And like, that is how they make their extra money. And I was wild to me. That was certainly not, when you say a while, how long has this been happening? This hasn't.
Oh, I bet it's been going on for 20 years.
I don't remember this being an option at all in college.
Plasma donations. They've been doing plasma donations for a while.
Maybe I should. Should I go to do this? Make some extra cash? All right. Well, when we come back, Alan Borsig is going to be here to talk about education in Wisconsin, what the big debates are going to be this year in the budget cycle. So stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Don't forget your books, you know you've got to learn the golden rule.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We got Jane Matinere on the board. No matter where you're listening across the Civic Media Network or on the Civic Media app, thank you for tuning in today. And a reminder that if you miss any part of today's show, you can always listen as a podcast wherever you find podcasts or at asgoeswisconsin.com. And as always, you can join the conversation at 844-967-2789. And our guest for this half hour is in studio. I'm so excited. Alan Borsig is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School. But he was also, prior to that, a journalist and reporter, a large time in the education beat at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for 30 years?
Close to a million years.
Close to a million years. 30, okay.
37 years I was there.
That is a very, very long time.
I agree.
What was the, I just had David Haynes, my old boss. He was in here a couple weeks ago. I think exactly 2 weeks ago. And so he finally hung it up after a very long time. What was the moment when you were like, all right, it's time?
Well, this was during the period where there were a lot of staff cutbacks from 2007 on. And they were offering a lot of money to leave. It was better money than now. And I finally said, I think I'll take the money. So becoming voluntarily unemployed at 59 might not have been the best idea ever, but I decided to do it and then ended up with this lovely job I have at Marquette Law School, which no one knows what I actually do.
I got to say, Alan, it's always been my biggest dream that people would just pay me to go away.
I'd been there 37 years, and it was the basic payout was two weeks per year, so that in itself is almost a year and a half. I finally decided it was time to go. And I liked it there. I liked what I was doing. Mm-hmm.
Well, as someone who now works there, I like it there. The newsroom is fun.
It's a very difficult business.
Yeah.
They're in a very difficult place, but they still got good people, and they're still the only newspaper in town. So
that is true. That is true. So, but you're still writing for them, which is how I first, as coming back to Wisconsin, doing the stuff that I do for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, doing stuff for the Here, reading your occasional. It's not really an op-ed because you approach all your stuff that you're writing still pretty objective, but you still comment on education in Wisconsin.
It started as what I regarded as a practical joke by Marty Kaiser, the editor of the paper at the time, that I was going to write these weekly columns after I left. And then I did it for 13 years. Pretty much without ever missing a Sunday, even when I went on vacation. So that was over 600 columns. And finally, last summer, I said, I'm kind of worn down and I'm repeating myself. I don't have 600 interesting things to say. So I've cut back since then, but I'm still writing for them. I regard myself like the commentator in the booth at a football telecast that I'll tell you how the game's going and what they need to do in the second half and how the offensive line screwed up and so on. But I won't fundamentally tell you who I'm rooting for. The who is it at the moment? The Chiefs or the Eagles?
Chiefs or the Eagles? Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Good. We were just talking about the Super Bowl. So I guess, which is such a funny thing, because it's one thing in that analogy where it makes a lot of sense of, oh, which team are you rooting for? But when it comes to education, there really should be teams, ideally, right? In a utopian situation.
I totally agree with that. I tell people my only real stand is I'm in favor of kids doing well in school, and I'm in favor of good schools. It just gets so complicated beyond that point. But if we really kept our eye on what's going to help kids, what's good for kids, what's going to produce the most positive outcomes for the most kids, I think the whole discussion would be a lot different than the way it is now.
And so what do you see? Because I want to get one of the articles that you wrote in the end of last year, so December 29th, 2022, kind of looking ahead at what the big topics are going to be during budget negotiation, during the election cycle for school boards. So I want to get to the different thing, like issues you outline there. But as far as someone who's been reporting on this for as long as you have and has seen the big change that happened really with Tommy Thompson and like, because me as a, I'm not a newcomer because I'm from here, but as far as coming back as an adult and like kind of head dive into all things Wisconsin politics, like the biggest thing I always see is one MPS always kind of being pointed as like an abject failure. And then also the debate, the really like heated debate about school voucher programs. And so how did we in it, because we only have 22 minutes, but like in your time reporting on this, and even now since retiring, but still writing on it, like, what do you kind of see as the milestones that got us to where we are? Because for a long time, didn't we have some of the best public schools in the country?
Well, that's fair to say, I think. So statewide and in the Milwaukee area, and Milwaukee Public Schools was a highly regarded district if you go back to the 60s and 70s and before that even. Times change. What can you say? If I had to pick milestones... court-ordered school desegregation, which began in Milwaukee in 1976, was ultimately not a success because the schools aren't so integrated.
Yeah.
But it did herald, and it was sort of the symbol of a huge change in demographics, a white flight from the city, rapidly growing Hispanic population starting in the 1970s. So that 1976 was a big milestone. 1990, when the state legislature and Tommy Thompson passed the first urban school voucher program in the country was a big milestone, but even bigger was 1998 when the state Supreme Court became the first high court in the land, the first court of that rank to find that it was constitutional to use public money to send kids to private schools and specifically religious schools. And, you know, the realities for MPS now are so different. The realities for public schools all across the state are so different. You left out money. Money's another big divide. You got money, you got vouchers, then you got a poor MPS, the everybody's whipping boy.
Everybody's whipping boy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so do you see, as you comment on it, and you don't say which team you're rooting for, even though we both agree that there shouldn't be teams, going into this budget cycle, going into the debates that are going to be happening in Madison. I guess first, because in the article, you started off with an entire analogy about the queen bees and the honey and the hives. Why did you choose that analogy?
Well, you got to choose something. You know, I really fear that there isn't much public interest in education issues. You got
really?
Yeah. I mean, stories don't get much reaction. The TV stations don't do much. I mean, ultimately, the level of public concern and urgency, if you ask someone like Howard Fuller, who's been a key figure in the education scene in Milwaukee for 50 years, he'd say, where's the urgency? Where's the urgency? This is true nationwide. It's true in Wisconsin. So you do try to make things readable. I mean, things get technical so easily, and they fall into people's knee-jerk reactions. So you try to, I do try to make it something that people can understand. And I hope prod people's thinking in a way that isn't limited to just their presuppositions coming into something.
Well, it's interesting that you say that you feel like, because I feel like since coming back, the conversations around school boards have been incredibly heated. I think the interested parties, and granted, I'm a childless person right now, so I think my deep-seated feelings on public school versus voucher school will be stronger potentially once I have kids. But I think the people who have kids care a lot, don't you?
They care about their kids and they care about their kids' schools. Do they care about the whole subject? I mean, I think that's one of the keys to what's going on with MPS is that the people who have power in the state, in the Milwaukee area, their kids are all going to Nicolet or Homestead or Elmbrook or who knows, or private schools, university school, who knows where. And they say, my kid's doing okay. What's the problem? So nobody really cares about MPS among people who have the real power. And I shouldn't say nobody, but it's a really short list. So MPS is like, why would I want to go there? If you were the governor, including sometimes Tony Evers, dare I say, he'd say, why do I want to go there? If you were Tom Barrett when he was the mayor of Milwaukee, he openly told people, why would I want to go there? It's a losing issue politically.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yeah. We're talking to Ellen Borsig, who is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School and is also a longtime education reporter at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he still occasionally writes a piece or two. And so we were talking about this piece you wrote at the end of December, and you kind of, without predicting what's going to happen, laid out what you think are going to be the major points of contention. And so the first one being revenue caps. And so has anything changed since you wrote this article and the rhetoric that has happened, whether it's the state of the state or the different political talk shows with LeMahieu and Voss, the different queen bees, shall we say, that's changed your perspective as far as how you think any of this is going to go since you wrote this piece?
Well, no, but the real opening gun hasn't been fired quite yet, which would be when the governor makes his budget proposal, which is coming up in 2.5 weeks, I believe, at which point the Republicans will take it and dump it in the wastebasket, which is what they did 2 years ago and 4 years ago. But nonetheless, then things will get a little more serious. But it won't really get serious until May and June. The last, I don't know how many, 4 or 5 state budget cycles. And Wisconsin has a 2-year budget cycle. It does not do annual budgets. And everything that's anything gets wrapped into the budget. So the first 6 months of an odd-numbered year, which is to say starting now, is the Super Bowl of Wisconsin decision-making, and particularly on schools. But the last, I bet, 4 or 5 budgets, which is to say going back a decade, the last thing on the table, the last day they do the budget, you know, sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning, is vouchers and what they're going to do with the voucher program. And I would not be at all surprised if that's true this time.
And so with the voucher program, because I feel like I've had this explained to me multiple times as far as the complicated web of the vouchers and the difference between charter schools and private schools and what the voucher gets you and who they work for, who they don't work for. So as far as, like, would this even work statewide? Because part of the issue that I always hear, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, with the voucher program is it's the more schools there are, the more schools that need funding, the less consolidated that money can be for any given school. And the argument for is that it creates competition, which is good. But in a populated place like Southeast Wisconsin, I kind of get it because there's enough people to create competition. But how does voucher schools work in more rural areas that can barely keep one public school populated, let alone create competition with another school?
That is such an interesting question. And to what degree we will find out more in this budget cycle is a really important question. Nationwide, in Republican-controlled states, just in the last few weeks, there's been a surge of legislation passed and has been signed by governors or will be signed by governors, Iowa, Utah, West Virginia, Arizona, a bunch of other states, that's creating, in effect, statewide voucher programs, or they call them scholarships or education saving accounts, or they've got different names, but it amounts to that. And that's the fear in just about every one of these states from the public school sector is we're going to lose kids, we're going to lose money, we're going to lose vitality, we're going to lose quality. You're going to hear that very strongly here. Now, Wisconsin is a little different because we've got the vetoer-in-chief, Tony Evers. If Tim Michaels had won the governor's election, we would have the sky's the limit on Republican initiatives here, and we would definitely have a statewide voucher program. With this stalemate and this these two tectonic plates colliding with each other, it's not clear what'll come out of it. Whether there'll be, there's been an expansion statewide. There's been expansion into Racine. There's been expansion into special education scholarship / vouchers. We have four different voucher programs in Wisconsin, actually. But they could be opened up far more. You're right, in a rural area, what would happen? But I'll tell you one thing that could happen now that we're more in the virtual schooling era. There is a voucher school in Milwaukee.
I have to cut you off because okay. We have to break. But Alan Vorsig will still be here when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Styling grace and watch the ankles break.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Our guest this half hour is Alan Vorsig, who is a longtime reporter on education issues in Wisconsin and also is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School. And I had to cut you off, so I'll let you finish what you were saying as far as how voucher a statewide. We're not going to be there because of the vetoer in chief. But
but at some point they have to agree on a budget, and how are they going to do that?
Yeah.
It's a really, really big question. I'm scooping myself because I intend to write a story about this for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm working on it. There's a school in Milwaukee, a private school, very conservative Christian school called the Academy of Excellence.
Good name.
And it has three physical facilities in the city of Milwaukee and about 770 students. But it also has 1,100 state of Wisconsin students, all from outside Milwaukee, all using Wisconsin voucher program routes to enroll in this Milwaukee school, all publicly funded to the tune of about $8,400 per kid. So these are conservative Christian families all across the state, many of them in really small towns, which is going back to your initial question. What happens in a town that doesn't have a lot of private schools? Who cares if they've got a voucher program? I mean, how many private schools are there in a place where they can barely have a public school district in northern Wisconsin and western Wisconsin and so on? But that's how is the virtual world is opening up a new thresholds for this.
So the Academy of Excellence is doing a lot of virtual learning, and
it's all virtual.
They
do not come to Milwaukee to go to school. They're all staying in who knows where, Cumberland or Black River Falls. But they're enrolled in a Milwaukee school, which is getting public money to educate these kids online using very conservative Christian curriculums, Bob Jones University, places like that. It's all perfectly legal.
Yeah.
I just think it's really interesting.
It is really interesting. Because it's also interesting as far as who's benefiting the most from the voucher programs. Because I think I've seen it in different, you know, this is all passing of tweets I've seen or a headline here or an article there as far as the, on its face value, saying that the voucher program is benefits the most needy, right? The low-income people who in the traditional sense of a public school district, the schools in their vicinity aren't very good. And so it gives them an opportunity to have more choice when they're going to school. But when you dig a little bit deeper, who's actually taking advantage of these voucher programs? And it's kids who are already maybe in a good school district or at different private schools. And is that the case in Wisconsin?
Well, if there's something like 44,000 kids in Wisconsin who are going to private schools using vouchers, 47,000. I don't remember the number for this year. There's 47,000 different stories. There's 115, 120 schools in the Milwaukee voucher program, including many that aren't in the city of Milwaukee. There's 120 different stories. That some of those are really good programs, really good schools, schools that would not exist without vouchers. And some of them are just strikingly mediocre. Mm-hmm. Mediocrity is by far the biggest problem with the voucher program, not horribleness, mediocrity. So it's all over the place. The original notion that vouchers would open the door to quality for everybody because parents would have choice and they all make good choices, frankly, it's not true. It didn't happen. It did happen in some cases. I'm summarizing about 30 years of work here. The problem is the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The people who are in the best position to make good choices for their kids are making good choices. And the people who come from perhaps multi-generational educational failure and dropouts and so on, and most dysregulated and dysfunctional homes, those are the kids who are ending up in the weakest schools. And that's true in the private sector, and it's true in MPS.
I'm just baffled, Ellen, as to why my tax dollar, because we do still have separation of church and state in this country, right? Ostensibly. Why are my tax dollars funding religious schools? I find that.
Remember, we only have 4 minutes before we have to.
Sorry.
Go.
Just kind of bugs me.
The phrase separation of church and state is not in the Constitution and not in the Bill of Rights. It's a Thomas Jefferson phrase, I believe, in its origin. Let me put it this way. It is legal, according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. And the reason is it's officially the money goes to parents and parents choose the school. So it's not going to religious schools. It's going to parents, similar to the GI Bill for people going to college.
Yeah.
So that's the logic of it. It is not supporting religion. It's supporting parents.
So because I feel like we have to have you back already because we only scraped the tip of all the different ways when we talk about education and people's opinions and your institutional knowledge about everything that's happened. So we're definitely going to come have you back. But I guess
I know too much weird stuff.
I love weird stuff. To end with, at least, because I also feel like there is, depending on who you're talking to, what report they decide to point to show how our schools are doing.
Right.
In the state of the state, as we were talking at the break, Governor Evers, who obviously spent his entire life as an educator, talked about how we're back in the top 10. Meanwhile, different Republican, conservative, school voucher heavy accounts that I follow across social media are constantly publishing reports about how bad our schools are doing. So as far as what is the best source of truth as a measurement of how schools are doing in your view?
Well, there's not one answer, okay. And I would take all the answers into account. I think there is a report that the governor cites that Wisconsin was rated highly. Frankly, I don't put too much weight on that. And it depends on where you're talking about. Are you talking about low-income kids in not only Milwaukee, but Madison, Beloit, Janesville, Appleton, Green Bay? Are you talking about minority kids? Are you talking about kids who are living in not only the well-to-do Milwaukee suburbs, but your more stable middle class or above smaller cities in Wisconsin, you know, the Fox Valley and so on. We're two states in so many ways. Yeah. And when it comes to education, we're about 50 states. The best thing for me to look at is a group of scores. And one of the reasons, you can overemphasize scores, but when every year they're the same, year after year, reading scores, math scores, graduation rates, attendance rates, Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. No, it's not called Wisconsin.
Policy Forum.
Policy Forum.
Love them.
I still flip back to old names. They just put out a report on extraordinarily high problems with the low attendance in the five biggest school districts in the state. So those kind of indicators, and in my mind, way at the top is reading. If kids aren't reading well, especially at the end of third grade, but then all the way up the ladder, they're not on track to do well beyond, and we have a huge reading crisis in Wisconsin, mostly related to those low-income kids I mentioned before. And, I mean, in the city of Milwaukee, the percentage of kids who score proficient or advanced in state reading tests every year for over 20 years has been 20% or lower. And now with the pandemic, it's dropped to more like 10%.
Yeah. Well, that will be the topic for the next time we have you on, because we have to let you go.
And
on that cheerful note, Ellen Borsig, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We will share this conversation. I think it's the first of many, because you have a lot to share and a very interesting perspective on all this. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm glad to be here in the studio with you and just to see the
finally
scene
meet you.
Yes, this
all
is
right.
Good.
Well, we have the top of the hour news. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.